From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fresh off Fox and Friends, able to go up 15 floors. I never take the elevator. As you know, I take the stairs. Allison, right? You know I take the 15. I'll skip a step once in a while, but I think it builds character. And I'm looking to build it. I need a lot of growth when it comes to character building. This hour, we got a huge roster of guests. Let me just start alphabetically on the R's. Micro. Is here, right?
So there's that.
Right. And then let me read the rest of the guests. Allison, you didn't book anybody else? This is it?
Oh,
what
boy.
The hell? No wonder you don't get any raises.
Don't worry, Allison. I brought my B-minus game. It's going to be amazing.
Well, you better have. He's the CEO, host, narrator, and executive producer of How America Works on Fox Business, and the star of Something to Stand For, which I got a screener for, which is so cool because it evaporates. It evaporates in three more days. So you didn't trust me to say if I send it to Brian, he won't share it and hurt the box office.
I know that you need a deadline. That's what I know about you. So you get 3 days.
I think the 26th. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I couldn't even see a calendar. I got so nervous. And I go, you know, I got to watch this. And I watched it. And it was one of those things where I watched it all day. Uh-huh. So I watched in the beginning. Then I went to work out. I brought it into the gym. I watched in the gym. And then I put it in the car, and I just thought it was, you know, because I love history.
Uh-huh.
And it is so good. It is so entertaining.
Thanks,
it is so interesting. And then to somebody who did 56 What Made America Great and tried to change them all, off the charts creative.
Thank you. I mean, I thought you'd like it. And in fact, you know, there are 9 stories in there. They're all these short mysteries. And one of them was actually inspired by you. I took a deep dive on the topic. It's a difficult film to promote without giving things away, right? Because all the stories are designed.
Could I tell you what book it is? Or should I not?
I don't think you should.
Okay.
I think we should just talk in a kind of good-natured code about this movie for a while.
Perfect for radio.
Yeah, it's the theater of the mind,
right,
folks.
Hi, we'd like to confuse the listeners and make sure you don't come back tomorrow. And Mike Rowe moves on to his myriad of projects, and Brian Kilmeade stuck with a show that turned off all our listeners.
Still taking the stairs.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Can't be confirmed, by the way. No witnesses. Because
really?
Nobody takes the stairs. So I have to go by myself.
You know, my friend Michael Easter, who wrote a book called The Comfort Crisis, has created a thing called the 2% Club, and he sells these hats just say 2%. And I'm like, what is this? And he says, 2% of the people in the United States, when given the choice between an escalator and a flight of stairs, will take the stairs. And those people invariably live better, live healthier, outperform, out-earn everybody else. So you're on to something.
Right. I'll tell you, I do the stairs.
You said doo-doo, by the way.
Right.
Let it be made clear. You just said doo-doo on your own show.
I'm allowed to. I'm pretty sure. And by the way, Eric is behind the board. You would like him. Probably better than me. And he would have knocked that out. So you don't have to tell him what to do. You don't have to always be in charge.
I'm just saying. Man says doo-doo and what appears to be prime time. Somebody ought to not only not cut it out, but maybe cut it into the open.
Since you came back,
mm-hmm.
We've added Richmond, Virginia,
nice.
WRVA.
Great.
We've added WTIC in Hartford and KLAF in Dallas.
That's a big one.
And we're about to add Hawaii. And right away, Allison, you're thinking market visit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
You've got to go to Maui just to let them know you're serious.
And they're going to want an A-lister to come with me.
Well, sure.
Right.
Sure.
Do you know of any?
I can make some calls.
Yeah, if you don't mind. So I want you to hear, we have a lot of news to talk about, and there's a lot going on with the blue-collar economy especially. But I want you just to finish this up to understand. We're coming up on year 250 of America's birth. Mike Rowe, in my opinion, like me, is a little concerned about the lack of patriotism in our country. I think things are beginning to switch. Here's an example of what you see when you watch his movie, which evaporates for me in 3 days. Cut 31.
My name's Mike Rowe, and this is Something to Stand For, a film that celebrates a few extraordinary Americans who risked everything to build the nation we call home. Americans who gave us something to fight for, something to be grateful for. And today, all these years later, something to stand for.
I'm about to take a trip to our nation's capital, not too far from where I grew up,
to reacquaint myself with the memorials and monuments built to honor the people in this film. In other words, it's a field trip.
And I'm glad you're along for the ride.
So we got a sense of that. I mean, it's built for video, but a sense of what you're doing. So it's an hour and a half?
It's closer to 2 hours, in total. It's 9 individual stories, all written in the style of Paul Harvey's old radio program, The Rest of the Story, where you learn something you didn't know about somebody you do. So essentially, it's 9 mysteries rooted in history, brought to life with some pretty elaborate recreations that, by the way, were all filmed in Oklahoma. There are 300 actors in this thing. They're all from Oklahoma. The crew, over 100 people, all from Oklahoma. There might have been 2 Texans, maybe. But this is not a Hollywood production. This is a message from the heart, and we wanted to deliver it from the heartland. And so we did. It's unapologetically patriotic. We did it specifically for Independence Day. And it's not quite a doc, right? And it's not your typical film either. But, you know, when I look around, I look at the headlines, man, we've talked about this before, the attack on our statuary, on our memorials, on our monuments, on the flag itself, it just demonstrates, in my mind, the disconnect that exists with so many people to the past that we all share. And the idea that we somehow can't celebrate the past or be proud of the past or be grateful for the past without also admitting that, look, we are a work in progress. Right. We're not done yet. And our country was founded by imperfect people. But we got ourselves so twisted up in this weird ball of guilt that we can't see clearly through the lens of history.
Yeah, we're so perfect now. Me and you and everybody else that we know is so perfect. And people you don't know, all right, that's why these statues really let us down on a daily basis. And you know what happened 2 weeks ago at the White House?
Yeah.
They surrounded the White House, tried to penetrate it, destroyed Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. They tried to, anyway, filled it with graffiti. They tried to tear it down in 2020, right in front of the White House. They also went over Rochambeau's statue,
yeah,
which this key French general that without him, we probably don't win the Revolutionary War. And they did the best to defile so much. And then I was able to speak last Thursday, at the National Archives. Right behind me is the Bill of Rights. Right behind me, when you walk in, is the Magna Carta.
Yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable through the history. And then the archivist started off the whole event by saying it wasn't too long ago when they hit it with foam. It looked like dust. They want to entice you to get it wet and clean it.
Yeah.
That would have solidified it. So they had to painstakingly pull out all the powder, and they're going to put these guys in jail eventually when they're charged. But these are just upstart idiots who feel as though the country has let them down and global warming is the big thing. I just can't wrap my head around it.
It's a temper tantrum, and it's playing out across the country. And if it's not about Hamas and Israel, maybe it's about big oil. If it's not about that, maybe it's about reparations. You can fill in the grievance blank. But they just sprayed Stonehenge with orange
yesterday
paint, right? So, look, this is not to say that protesting is bad. We have the right to do it, and this movie is not an indictment on people on one side of
that's
the aisle.
That's not your style.
No, I don't. That's the last thing I need. But look, as we get to Independence Day, you know, rather than having a big left versus right or liberal versus conservative conversation, I think it'd be more useful to talk about American versus anti-American. That's a real thing now. And this movie, you know, was not made for anti-Americans. It was made because of them, honestly.
Well, I was playing soccer with my daughter yesterday, and one of the things, Megan Rapinoe, for a while, one of the better known soccer players in the world, she looks at me and she does it, you know, she's not big into history. She just says, why would a national team allow a player to take a knee? What does the rest of the world think when you take a knee during our national anthem? And that's just not her personality to bring up things in the news because I guess she's been inundated with it, or history. It really bothered her. And I wonder how many other people are bothered to the point where it's not cool anymore. And my answer is, it's not. We're not sitting for the national anthem anymore. We're not kneeling. Things have gotten better. So I do think we went through the convulsion, which is why last week or 2 weeks ago was so especially revolting to see them go back.
Right.
Also, with your movie and movies like it, the more people are educated, the less they're going to feel compelled to do something to Andrew Jackson, to do something to Abraham Lincoln's memorial. Don't you agree?
Well, you have to start with curiosity. If you're not a curious person, then you've got a fundamental problem. It's so much easier today to judge than it is to think. And to be curious, you have to be willing to think, and you have to be willing to be wrong. You know, I could say the same thing about science.
Right.
But the idea of judging the present through the lens of the past, that's childlike. And Reagan was right. This happens every generation. You know, we are always one generation away. We need not to educate, Brian, because nobody wants a lecture. Nobody wants a sermon. Nobody wants a lesson. You have to entertain first. You know that. You write books that do that same thing. You have to tell a story, and you have to do it in a way, I think, that is accessible. People have limited attention spans, more limited than ever. Most people don't have 2 hours to sit in a theater. But these stories were all written for the curious mind with a short attention span. They were all originally written for a podcast. Then they turned into a book. Then they turned into a TV show. Now they're becoming a movie because people still want to learn. You just have to entertain them first.
So, you know, I told you on stage, and one day I'm going to get you down there. I'm able to talk about all the history books and even the two sports books I did, The Games Do Count, is How You Play the Game. I want to be inspirational, motivational, and patriotic. But I try not to make it a lecture. There's no teleprompters or anything. Try to move through the stories quickly. And I have people come up to me, and they're highly educated people, and they'll say to me, I never knew any of that. Why? Because you're a business major. You're a doctor.
Yeah.
How much time do you have time to spend in history? Do I need that as a requirement? I move on. For me, I can't wait for my history political science course. For doctors, people not science-oriented, or blue-collar, weren't really, school wasn't their thing. And because they didn't pay attention in their teens, they're done. How many times are they going to go pick up a history book? So sometimes you could whet people's appetite to learn more. And I always ask, you have to be into science to be a doctor. I know you do certain, but you don't have to be into history to love it, because I asked you two questions. Number one, do you like stories? Do you like two stories? Maybe three. There's three actually. Number one, what about stories about your country? They usually say yes to all three.
Sure.
Here you go.
Yeah.
This is your story, and don't tell it for the Harvard audience. Tell it for the everyday audience.
That's right. And if you can, tell it inside out. You know, don't start in the obvious place. That's what we used to do in school anyway. And so as a result, people understand that Fort McHenry was the site of a battle. Some people know it was 1812, and some people know that that's when the Star-Spangled Banner was written. But most people don't know that the Star-Spangled Banner was a drinking song called To Anacreon in Heaven. It became a protest song.
Right.
It's the mother of all protest songs. But they don't realize that, because the symbology has evolved, and so suddenly people see the flag and hear the anthem and associate it with a different thing. But I think part of the confusion too today is that we are awash in symbols. Everything has become a talisman. That mask that we wore for a couple of years no longer really has anything, if it ever did.
Well, now what's it used for?
It's a sign. It's a thing people can wear to possibly express a set of beliefs. I don't want to get in anybody's
head. I don't want my identity known, which shows you're a coward.
And there's that too. Oh, well, look, if you're talking about the business of protesting with a mask on, then it's incumbent on you to explain how you're any different from a Klansman. It's incumbent on you.
I hear you.
If you show up angry with a can of spray paint and your face is wrapped in a bandana or concealed in any way, you have to tell me how you're any different from a cross-burning bigot in 1930.
When we come back, a history study was just done. A poll was just taken. You'll be surprised how America views their Confederate past. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show, full hour with Mike Rowe. We'll talk about everything. Don't move.
It's expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Mike Rose here, and he's got a new documentary. Would we call it a documentary? Call it a movie.
Call it a movie.
All right, it's not a doc. He's a narrator, executive producer, star of How America Works. He's also, you see him in this brand new, I guess we can call it a documentary, Something to Stand For. It's a documentary like you've never seen before. It's got so many different elements and surprises, and it features a lot of you. And if you want to love the country more, you watch this. I saw this study out. So this big thing about taking Confederate statues, I understand it. So they asked the American people, 52% support efforts to preserve the legacy and history of the Confederacy, 44% oppose such efforts. And that they all don't live in the South, in America.
Right.
We used to judge. We used to study. Okay,
right.
This is what he stood for. Let me learn more about this. I remember doing something with Lindsey Graham, and he looked up and he pointed to a Confederate statue. He goes, they were good people. They were just wrong. This is the society they were born into.
Right.
And we overlook Fort Sumter. And he goes, right there is where it all started. But we're able to tell the story because I could play off that statue.
One of the things that we might want to ask ourselves, right? I mean, it does require a bit of nuance, context, and perspective to look back and start making conclusions. But so, too, does it require those things if you look forward 150 or 200 years. I mean, nobody's got a magic eight ball, but what are our great-great-great-great-grandkids going to think about what we're doing in 2024? And fill in the blank. Like, how are we going to remember meat eaters? Okay, let's say we haven't eaten meat for 100 years, either because we've developed something that's so synthetically superior, so who knows what could happen to get us to that place. The question is, are we going to look back and go, you know, who was eating meat in 2024?
What were they thinking? It's a living animal.
I saw Barack Obama eat a steak once. We better get his statue down.
Right.
How are we going to be judged today? I mean, it could be capital punishment. It could be abortion. Fill in your hot button du jour, and we're going to be weighed and measured somewhere down the road. And personally, I mean, again, I don't know, but it is a heck of a thing to look back at Jefferson and go, good, 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 good. Ooh, that was not good. Therefore, he didn't exist. Damnation memoriae, the Romans used to call it, you know,
right.
Where your statuary would be either disfigured or removed, along with your memory. And so, look, Santa Anna said it pretty well, right? Those who don't remember the past are doomed to repeat it. But today, I would say that those of us who aren't connected to it, who aren't curious about it, we're just blind.
Right.
We're just blind.
And it's fun to study these guys. It could happen to your own life today, by the way. When we come back, Francis Scott Key Bridge is now in the news. Are they going to rename that? That's also part of your movie.
Wow.
And you're not going to believe it.
The Brian Kilmeade Bridge. I wonder what the toll is going to be.
Right. If they are thinking about naming it after me, how dare you leak that out? Mike Rowe.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. We got a full hour with Mike Rowe and a little bit longer to talk. So, Mike Rowe, one thing that's pretty clear is we are buried in debt. We are going to have $50 trillion in debt in 20 years. If you want to have a country that should panic about something aside for a war, which is not transparent, this is going to kill us. was spending way too much on social programs. And when you cut back a program, you looked as unpatriotic or you don't like poor people. How do we get out of something like this?
It's the first thing Bobby Kennedy told me. We had a meeting months ago.
RFK Jr.
Yeah. And, you know, he said, look, this is, to me, the great existential thing. We get to $50 trillion. We can't service it. And truly nothing else will matter. There will be nothing else to be done. The party's over. So it's coming. I'll tell you, the short answer is I don't know. I mean, it's going to be very, very painful. But it seems that you've got to look at, God, man, you've got to look at the industrial military complex. You've got to look at pharma. You've got to look at, I mean, there's just so much money wrapped up in so many things. And nobody, at least in the next decade, in my opinion, is going to get elected by candidly telling the people the truth. Right. That just hasn't worked so far. It is going to have to go splat, I think, first, before people really start really, really, truly get that memo.
Well, here's what I think. You know, if you explain to people we are a country that understands technology now. We don't have to sit there and pretend we don't have PowerPoint. You don't have to sit behind a Resolute desk and just stare at your president. But a man or woman in their second term, they could say our non-discretionary spending is getting smaller and smaller, and our discretionary is getting bigger and bigger. Our discretionary spending is getting smaller and smaller. So we're going to have very little play. When you see the automatic withdrawal coming out of our account, we can't afford, and then we look at the interest rate. You explain that to people, and then you tell us the plan moving forward,
yeah,
and that we can't afford all this social spending. I think people would begin to get it, at least get us in the right trajectory. But when you raise interest rates, it's really just catapulting our debt. Do you know we're overdrawn $1.9 trillion this year?
Mm-hmm.
So whatever we're spending now, people are dissatisfied. They still think we're not spending enough, or they're not getting enough, but we're spending it on the wrong things in many cases. I think you could actually make a profit off the military spending with their threats everywhere, our allies everywhere, many of which have money to pay for the stuff that we're making.
I'll tell you, the thing that bothers me mathematically, and I don't really mean to compare these two things because they're each excellent reasons to lose sleep at night. But the more immediate mathematical problem revolves around the numbers 5 and 2. Every year, for every 5 tradespeople who retire, 2 people replace them. This has been going on for about 18 years. And the math has become so critical and so underreported. You can't find a single major corporation today who relies to some degree on skilled labor who isn't struggling to hire. This is I sound like a broken record with this, but Brian, not a week goes by where I don't talk to a big organization who is quietly saying, we don't know how this is going to come out. The American Industrial Submarine Complex contacted me. I'm advertising for them now on my podcast. Why? Because they've got to build a Virginia-class and a Columbia-class nuclear-powered sub every year for the next 10 years. To keep the cadence up, they need 100,000 skilled tradespeople over a 10-year period. 100,000. And they're looking at the same talent pool as Caterpillar and Komatsu and Ford and General. I mean, just go down the list. So this is only a matter of national security. And just because my foundation is in the thick of it doesn't mean it's not true. My slip might be showing here a little bit, and sorry to commandeer your rant with this one. But if we're going to talk about scary numbers, that's scarier to me. Because we are right on the verge of not being able to make stuff.
All right. You do get the sense that people are going back into the trade just a little bit?
They are. And that's great. But we're turning a tanker around, right? And a lot of what has to happen, it's not just enough to point to the opportunities and say, look, you can make 6 figures welding. Look at this. Here's how you do it. You have to unwind the stigmas and the stereotypes and the myths and the misperceptions that have not only infected Gen Z, but their parents,
right,
and guidance counselors.
So a couple of things. They told us the robots were going to be doing all these. You better get another job. You better be indispensable. And, you know, that your job is going to be lost.
Yeah.
And I talked to my cousin, who is a service manager at Ford, for Lincoln Ford, for years. And he says, you know, I can't even work on my own car. Like, I can work on stuff there, but everything's automated. You got to update classes. It's hard to get mechanics, number one. But number two, a lot of this stuff is almost solid state these days. And also, when you come to the electric car,
yeah,
it's like that battery needs to be replaced. That's really the only moving part you got.
That's right. You need, I mean, the...
So that's what's scaring mechanics away.
That's right. But it shouldn't, because the need is absolutely pressing. I'm doing a project right now with this great organization called Barrett Jackson, who's creating with another company called Sugar Creek, this unbelievable car or this truck for MicroWorks that we're going to auction off. We're going to raise a lot of money. And they're doing it precisely because they need to call attention to the crushing shortage of mechanics in the pipeline right now that they and all their competitors rely on. I think we're going to live to see companies like UPS and FedEx come together to make a more persuasive case for truck drivers, for instance, because the truck driving shortage is acute, over 50,000 right now. You just go down the list, and nobody is close to being where they need to be. And so, right. Look, if making stuff in this country matters, if a balanced workforce is important, if the skilled trades are still a thing, this is it, man. I'm ringing the alarm bell.
Gotcha.
It's about to tip.
So I watched the Boeing hearings the other day. I had to flip over to watch the hearings when people were carrying it. And I found it. And this Boeing CEO is being skewered. And one thing that Ron Johnson said, he goes, you know, I was in manufacturing before, I was in plastics, before I got this job as a senator. He goes, how hard is it to get jobs to work on the line, a manufacturing job? He goes, it is really hard. Now, planes are falling out of the sky. That's part of the reason. So he still makes $32 million last year. His car, the Boeing, by all accounts, had a horrendous, horrific year, and he got a $4 million bonus. I want you to hear this exchange with Josh Hawley.
But meanwhile, you're getting paid a heck of a lot of money. It's unbelievable. If anybody's coming out of this deal good, it's you. Why haven't you resigned?
Senator, I'm sticking this through. I'm proud of having taken the job. I'm proud of our
safety record.
And I am
proud
of our Boeing people.
You're proud of this safety record?
I am proud of every action we have taken.
Every action you've
taken?
Yes,
sir.
Wow. Wow. There's some news for you. Well, behind you, you can't see it. Behind you, the folks are showing pictures of the people who are the victims of your safety record. I think we can all see them. And I think the American public, when they fear to get on their airplanes, they understand your safety record. And frankly, sir, I think it's a travesty that you're still in your job.
A little bit of they had whistleblowers go out, and they went after the whistleblowers. The whistleblowers that were on the line saw some of this stuff and the quality dropping, and they said, okay, we'll eliminate the whistleblowers.
This goes back to your first question. You know, what has to happen for that $50 trillion debt to come down? And one of the things is people are – that guy's going to be forced to give a better answer, because before you ask people to start foregoing their Social Security and sacrificing on these massive, massive levels, you're going to have to understand why the guy in charge can get that kind of coin while his products is falling out of the sky. It goes back to the emperor's new clothes. The country's going to have a fit, Brian, at some point. I was talking to Riley Gaines the other day on my podcast, who's terrific, by the way.
Really talented.
And I said, Riley, you are, in so many ways, like the little kid in that Hans Christian Andersen story, The Emperor's New Clothes. You're surrounded by townspeople who are all pretending that the emperor looks great in his new clothes. But he's naked. And you're the one who said, no, look, he's naked. And then slowly the townspeople are like, oh, yeah, he's naked. I think we're entering a time when we're all going to have to decide, are we townspeople standing there like sheep pretending that the plane isn't falling out of the sky? Are we going to pretend that the Afghans weren't falling out of the plane during that very successful withdrawal? Are we going to pretend the border is secure as we see thousands of people coming across?
Are we going to pretend, I'll say this because you won't, that the president was not wandering off of the G7? And are you going to yell at people for pointing it out? Are you going to pretend that Barack Obama did not have to grab the president's hand and put his hand on his neck to get him off the stage? Are we going to pretend that he wasn't frozen on that Juneteenth celebration? Literally totally frozen
and
get mad at people for pointing it out.
And to be fair, and I'm not going to run down the same laundry list on the other side, but they have every right to do the same thing. How can you not see the townspeople?
They do.
They all feel the same way. We all are certain. We're very long on certainty, and we believe that we've seen the truth. But we're like the blind men walking up to the elephant and grabbing the tusk and concluding erroneously that what we have our hands on is an ivory statue. Somebody else grabs the tail, somebody else grabs the trunk, somebody else grabs the leg, and they have a very different opinion of what the thing is. But they're certain. They're as certain as the other side. It's just that they're wrong. Mm. They're wrong in a different way. So find the townspeople. Find the kid who's brave enough to see a thing for what it is and say it out loud, right? Gosh, mommy, that championship female swimmer has something in her bathing suit that looks like that thing daddy has. What's up?
Right.
And now mommy has to explain, right? We're trapped in the clutch of the cognitive dissonance that comes from being told not to believe what we can see. And that guy yesterday proved it. I'm proud of my safety record. There's nothing to see over here. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Yes, I'll take my bonus, please. Life is swell.
Right, and I had somebody here, and I'll take a break here to save some time on the other side. But we had a guy here that was a self-made billionaire, and he wants to be in Treasury. Probably will, could be Treasury Secretary next. And he told me, he goes, I go, what do you do when you study? He said, when I study this, I get worried about a class warfare. I go, class warfare? He goes, oh, yeah. The working class is not getting a piece of this. Things are going backwards for them, and they deserve better. And I thought, that's interesting coming from a billionaire. And that's why he wants to get into government.
Good for him.
Yeah. More with Mike Rowe in just a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You believed an institutional should make it hard for people to live their lives so they'd feel pressured to get vaccinated. Could we run the audio clip on that, please?
You think can be done about it? I have to say that I don't see a big solution other than some sort of mandatory vaccination.
You want to come to this college, buddy? You're going to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Big corporations like Amazon and Facebook and all of those others are going to say, you want to work for us, you get vaccinated. And it's been proven that when you make it difficult for people in their lives, they lose their ideological and they get vaccinated.
So that's Anthony Fauci on a book on tape, just was an audio book, and Rich McCormick was the one who rolled that in. Why was Congressman Rich McCormick so perfect for this? Because he was a doctor at that time in the military treating people for, and some of which did not want that, did not want the vaccine, treating people during this, and he thought it was a total overreaction. He thought the lockdown was ridiculous. And when he brought that up, he was criticized within the military, within government. Now he's a congressman in front of Anthony Fauci, who's trying to change history, and said he never knocked everyone down. He never said 6 feet apart. He never said keep the kids out of school past the 2 weeks. No one's buying it. And we heard, in my estimation, the real him just now. Mike Rowe, you live a life in which you answer to yourself and your business, putting together products. I'm harking back to 2020. We still don't have answers to what was behind that lockdown and how many lives were destroyed by people who told us they knew better and were trying to protect us.
It's very important to understand who was the emperor, who were the townspeople, and who was the kid telling the truth. It's very, very important to understand that, because the consequences of believing all those certain sounding people have been, we still don't quite know. I honestly think, Brian, we are still in a collective state of PTSD to the point where we don't even really want to hear about it. It's just too unpleasant to think about what we went through and how we were pushed into it.
Doing stuff that we didn't want to do, giving up our jobs, giving up school, playing sports with a mask on outside, and then having people say, no mask, no reason to wear a mask. Wear a mask. How dare you take that mask off? then I never told you to wear a mask. Really? So well, here we are in 2024, a guy's trying to sell a book after he destroyed so many lives and say, by the way, I got everything right. Any problem? You don't like science. That's still Anthony Fauci's mantra.
This is too political for me, probably, but I'll say it. The 51 people who went on record saying that that laptop was definitively the product of Russian disinformation.
Three CIA directors.
Right. Now, look, the reason that's a problem isn't because it's biased, and it's not even because it was untrue. It's because who are we going to believe next? How can you tell the average American that they're a blank denier when dozens of experts, in quotes, come up to tell us something about fill in the blank? Maybe it's the climate. Hey, look, we have 100 scientists who are telling us this, this, and this. You can't blame the average American for being skeptical.
Yes.
To go, well, but wait,
of course.
You just had the most venerated political operatives in the country swearing, putting their name in a giant page in a newspaper of record saying this thing is not what you think it is. So you just add that again and again and again, over and over in every conceivable vertical, and then you have the temerity to smack an American for daring to be skeptical about the claims of any institution.
Right.
That's where we are now.
And I'll just add to this. Mark Cuban said, I'll never vote for any presidential candidate that would deny global warming. He also said one of his best investments was his private plane. John Kerry says we better get him. We only have very little time left. This guy doesn't go anywhere without a private jet. His answer is, well, it's my wife's.
Every doomsayer, I guess the word is. Obviously, they've been wrong.
Right.
For millennia,
sorry, we're
it's
still
wrong.
Around.
6 years ago, we were told we have 12 years.
Yes.
6 years are left. I guess you only have to be right once.
Yes.
If that's what you're selling, but nobody's ever gotten it right.
All right. So listen, Mike, when is your movie coming out?
June 27th.
How are we going to call it?
Well, I'm going to call it Something to Stand For because that's the title. I'm going to suggest that your listeners, full disclosure, if you go to somethingtostandfor.movie and if you watch the trailer, you're going to be virtually powerless not to go see the film. It's that compelling. So heads up.
It's only going to be in theaters for a short amount of time.
1 week. It's a love letter to our country for Independence Day from the 27th of June through the 4th of July.
And if you want to get your kids patriotic, bring them to this.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. From 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'd argue the fastest growing in the country. We're lucky enough to add a great affiliate in Dallas as well as Richmond. And now Hartford, WTIC, is now aboard. We're about to have another big announcement next week. So I appreciate everyone being here. Jeff Lax, a City College law professor at Kingsborough Community College, who's got a brain in his head, unlike these crazy lefties in this city, is pushing back against the anti-Semitism, which is taking over way too many college campuses. He's talking about what's happening lately over at where he works. And being that he's tenured, he can speak out and not feel reprisals. He'll talk about that. He also will weigh in on what we're supposed to see now any moment. Some decisions on this from the Supreme Court, one of which everyone's looking for is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump finding out if the president is immune from prosecution when he's president of the United States. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration has been withholding weapons and ammunition to Israel.
We generally do not know what he's talking about.
Really? You never know what you're talking about, KJP, but the Prime Minister of Israel knows what happens when weapons don't show up. He speaks out. Fracture. Netanyahu tells the truth, and Biden administration offers a rebuke as the weapons slowdown to an ally at war goes public as danger ramps up and war is closer than ever to expanding to the northern front.
Number two.
He approached the young
couple, two 13-year-old kids, tied them up, put a gag in their mouth, raped the young woman, and asked them to stay there for 20 minutes.
And took their phones. Death, rape, and outrage, the three emotions stemming from the broken southern border. It's poisoning our communities in every way, in many cases posing a grave danger like the one you just heard. There's no end in sight. Only an election can stop it.
Number one.
I think like any divorce, there's not just one thing. There's a series of things that led up to it, right? The Dems were policing the wrong things.
That is some people among the left who think that Joe Biden's strategy to beat Donald Trump is just wrong. Meanwhile, RFK barred from the debate stage. New polls are in as debate preps have begun, and some of the left begin to question Joe's game plan for winning in November, which is talk about January 6th, talk about democracy being in danger, and how unhinged Donald Trump is. On the left, they don't think it'll work. What about Mark Thiessen, Washington Post columnist? He's a fellow at the AEI. Host of his own podcast, What the Hell is Going On, and a Fox News contributor. Mark, do you understand those on the left who think that's not a good strategy? Or do you agree with Joe Biden? Leave me alone. Let me make my own decisions.
Well, first of all, the idea that he's making the decisions is kind of humorous. He's not quite fully in control of his faculties. I think a lot of people are making decisions for him. But put that aside for a minute. It's the only play he has. I mean, you look at the numbers. He is underwater by double digits on every single issue that the American people care about. 61%, 55%. New York Times, Siena poll. 55% of Americans consider Donald Trump's presidency to be a success. 61% consider Biden's presidency to be a failure. So he is the most unpopular president in the history of presidential polling, going all the way back to the end of World War II. So he's got no positive case to make for his agenda. The only case he can make is look at Trump. Look at Trump. Because if this election is a referendum on Joe Biden, it's going to be a landslide for Trump.
So
he's got to make it a referendum on Trump, and Trump's got to avoid helping him do that.
Well, we do know this. In a head-to-head poll for the first time since October of 2023, he beats Trump by two. National polls don't mean much, but it does show a trend. Just a slight uptick is in approval. According to Fox, it has gone up to 43%. Now that we're here, Donald Trump in a five-way race loses by one, in a two-way race loses by two. But we know it's going to break down state to state. And Donald Trump has never been leading in any poll pretty much on the national poll ever since winning the primary. But I got to ask you a couple other things. When it comes to this debate in particular, I watched Donald Trump lowering expectations yesterday, one of which he said is the current president's going to be jacked up on something. He said drugged up. He also said to his followers, it's going to be 3-on-1. Do you believe it'll be 3-on-1? Jake Tapper, Dana Bash, Biden against Trump?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, look, Joe Biden is going to want to make the debate about Donald Trump. It's going to want to make it about the 2020 election. He's going to want to make it about January 6th. And so will CNN. And so Trump has to avoid letting them hijack what the debate is about. He needs to when they say, let's talk about 2020, he should say, yeah, you're right. Let's talk about 2020. In 2020, the border was secure. In 2020, inflation was under control. In 2020, the world was at peace. Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine again. Hamas and Iran hadn't invaded Israel. I'd love to talk about 2020 and compare it to 2024, because I think most Americans look at 2020, look at 2020 and look at 2024 and say, you know, things are better off in 2020, despite the pandemic, despite the racial unrest, despite the economic crisis. We were better off back then. That's what he's got. That's how he has to frame this message. He cannot let them drag him into debating on their terms.
And I think one thing that's understated that I think can't be overstated, and that's have a good time. I mean, the Donald Trump that went up there was in 2016 winning. There was some sparring sessions that were really tough against Rubio and Jeb Bush. I understand that. But for the most part, Trump was having a good time. He on the stump, he's having a good time again. And even Chuck Todd pointed that out. This carefree Donald Trump calling into all these shows, taking on old comers, is beginning to show up on the stump.
Yeah, I agree with you. Look, he be a happy warrior. I think the moment he lost the 2020 election was during that first debate. He was angry. He was interrupting. He was attacking. He wouldn't let Biden finish his sentence. And if you think about what people liked and didn't like about Donald Trump in 2020, they liked his policies. They didn't like his behavior. And they saw his behavior in the first debate and they said, I'm done with that. I can't take that anymore, even though I'm doing better off. How bad could Biden be? He's going to unite the country. He's going to bring us together. He's a centrist. He's a moderate. Let's take a risk on him. And now a lot of people have buyer's remorse. And so what Trump needs to do is not remind them what they disliked about him. Remind voters what they liked about him, what they liked about him. And quite frankly, he's funny. If you watch one of these rallies, I know a lot of swing voters and non-Trump voters never do. He's funny. He's having fun. Be charming. Show your charming side. Don't get angry. Don't get vicious. And don't remind people about the things they didn't like about you in 2020. Remind them what they like, which is your policies, and contrast your policies with what he's done over the last 4 years, and say that people are you better off now than you were 4 years ago. The Reagan, classic Reagan question. That's how you win.
So I was pretty amazed to see what's going on now with Russia and North Korea, Russia and China, Iran and Russia. They are really in real time forming their own modern Axis powers. And now Russia goes over to visit Vietnam. We know that the Filipinos, an ally of ours, just got their boat rammed by the Chinese. We know that the Russians put their some rusted out Navy ships into Cuba, just 90 miles off our coast. So if you look at what's happening in the Middle East, we're at war with our own ally, with Israel, and Ukraine, underfunded with too many restrictions. If Trump was president right now, and you know my passion for foreign policy, I'd have trouble defending anything I just said. I'd say these policies are actually bringing us closer to a world war than any time in my life. Yet they're using this as an excuse to blame Trump on MSNBC. Yesterday, they were saying, well, being that Trump is close to regaining power in some polls, they say it emboldened dictators because he wants to be a dictator. Do you believe this?
That's insane. Look, here's just fact, okay? The only president in the 21st century on whose watch Vladimir Putin did not invade one of his neighbors is Donald Trump. He invaded Georgia at the end of the Bush administration. He invaded Ukraine first time under the Obama-Biden administration. He did nothing under the Trump administration. Then as soon as Trump was out of office, he invaded Ukraine again when under Biden. That's just a fact. The only president since Ronald Reagan on whose watch America hasn't been drawn into a new war, either directly or by proxy. I mean, the reality is the world – people think that Donald Trump is an isolationist. He's not an isolationist. This is the guy who whacked Qasem Soleimani, who bombed Syria twice, who knocked the hell out of ISIS and kicked it out of its caliphate, who told the North Koreans, if you don't stop threatening America, I'm going to unleash fire and fury, the likes of which the world has never seen. And they all listened. When Donald Trump was president, he didn't withdraw from the world. He made our enemies withdraw.
Right.
He made our enemies retreat. And so that's why we had peace. And people thought, I remember Peter Schweitzer, our mutual friend, wrote a great book after the Cold War called Reagan's War, where he went in and looked at the Soviet Union. The Russians were so poor, they sold the Soviet archives to the Hoover Institution. So you could actually go and read the minutes of the Politburo meetings. And they actually believed Ronald Reagan would start a launch of nuclear first strike. That's why they were deterred. Not since Ronald Reagan have our adversaries been so worried that our leader was crazy enough to attack mm-hmm. them than Donald Trump. And that's why they didn't test him.
There's a very interesting, I've been asking for this for a long time. I want to see Republicans compete in urban environments, and I want to see Democrats go for the rural vote. But now the president went to South Bronx. He went to Detroit. He's going to Philadelphia on Saturday. And he's beginning to make inroads with the black vote to the point where James Clyburn's incensed. Listen to what he said yesterday, and I want you to answer his question. Cut four.
His anger was he wanted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. So I ask anybody in this country, black or white, do you think you're better off without the Affordable Care Act? And that's what this man says he's delivered for African Americans. I ask them to show me one single substantive thing that he has done that would make black Americans proud to be a part of his effort.
You want to answer him?
Yeah, so this reminds me of the Monty Python skit where they're saying, well, what have the Romans ever done for us? Well, they're the roads and the aqueducts. I don't know. What has Donald Trump done for the black community? Let's see. Black unemployment was historically low under Donald Trump's presidency. He delivered criminal justice reform. He created enterprise zones with Tim Scott to bring money. He provided permanent funding for historically black colleges, something that the first black president, Barack Obama, didn't do. I mean, I could go on. And here's the thing. The Democrats always say Republicans don't even try to compete for the black vote, you know, because they don't care about black Americans. And now you got a Republican president who's going into the black community and saying, I want your vote. And they're criticizing him for it. And the reason is they're worried he's going to get it. And look, Donald Trump doesn't have to win the African-American vote. He got 12% of the African-American vote in the last election. He's now polling at 23%. If he gets 23% or even close to 23% of the black vote, the election's over. Joe Biden can't win. Democrats have to have 80-85% of the black vote in order to win elections in this country, because they've become a coalition of coastal elites and minorities. And if you eat into that vote even marginally, if he can even increase his percentage of the black vote by 5-10% over what he got last time around, Biden is toast.
Vice president race is on. He's got to name it in a couple of weeks at the RNC. We know the finalists are Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, Governor Burgum, J.D. Vance, I believe, are on that list. And Byron Donalds is pulling up on the outside. And they say Elise Stefanik, but she's been invisible since she made that list. Your thoughts about what the Mark Thiessen right running mate would be?
So I published in the Post today that of that list, I think Tom Cotton would be a great, great choice. You know, the future of the Republican Party is harnessing the energy of the populist movement tempered by conservative principles. And I think Tom Cotton has done an amazing job in appealing to both factions of the Republican Party, and he could help Donald Trump do that. But I still think there are people off that list that ought to be in consideration. I think that he really ought to give serious thought to Nikki Haley. And if not Nikki Haley, another person who would be great would be Kim Reynolds in Iowa, one of the best governors who's delivered school choice. There's a lot of people that he ought to consider. And I think Donald Trump is the kind of person who, you know, I mean, if you remember, Mike Pence endorsed Ted Cruz in the final stretch, and then he picked him. I think Donald Trump is a pretty magnanimous guy, and he will make a decision that's what is best for getting his ticket elected. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's somebody off that list.
That would be typical Trump to surprise everybody. Yep. Glenn Youngkin is somebody I heard they had a good initial
Absolutely.
Meeting. And man,
Absolutely.
Is that guy competent? The other thing, I just need people
Virginia
to
Virginia in play. If right. Trump wins Virginia, the election's over.
That's a great point. Yeah, it probably is, because right now the Wall Street Journal wrote yesterday they believe Pennsylvania live or die, but not if you deliver New Hampshire and Virginia. You take back Georgia and Arizona, and then you stay ahead in Nevada. I think you got to redo a lot of math.
Yep. Amen.
All right. Thanks so much, Mark Thiessen. And finally, I'm going to you have to commit to come on before the debate so we get your final pregame thoughts.
Is that 100%. Anytime right. You want me, Brian.
You got it. Mark Thiessen, thanks so much. He's a host of the podcast, What the Hell is Going On, and a Fox News contributor. Back with your calls in a moment. First time, I know. 1-866-408-7669.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Something very strange has been happening up in Vermont, and it involves Democratic State Representative Jim Carroll. Here's what's going on. Over the past few months, Representative Carroll has been repeatedly finding his tote bag drenched in water without any indication of what caused it. A tote bag caper. At first, Carroll thought it might just be snow that had fallen into his bag, but then it kept happening well into springtime, so he set up a secret camera outside of office. And this is what it captured. Okay, there's Jim Carroll. He's hung up his bag, making sure everything's fine with it. He walks away, not a care in the world. And wait, what's this? Here's that lady empties her drink into his tote bag. It's a political scandal that some are calling Watergate.
It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah, just totally crazy.
Like, this is what politicians are doing up in Vermont.
Right.
She's pouring water in this man's bag. Why? I mean, it's actually sort of funny if it wasn't politicians doing it.
So stupid, especially with surveillance cameras everywhere. Stephen Colbert pulling out the golden nuggets. Some of you guys are writing me. First off, this one about J.D. Vance is interesting. So J.D. Vance is a leader. By the way, Lawrence Jones went and interviewed him yesterday at his house. He found it fascinating, you know, obviously rural background. Everyone voted Democrat in his house. He thought he'd be a Democrat his whole life. And now it looks like he is used to rip Donald Trump all the time. And now he's gone down to 180. And this is from Lynn. Lynn says, J.D. has the stones to admit the many derogatory comments he made about Trump in the past were mistakes. Hence, the new rhetoric, 100% of folks have changed their minds about something at one point, is far fewer percent of those folks has the stones to admit it out loud. So do it. You could help win over people is what Lynn is saying. If you just admit I made a mistake and now I'm all in for Donald Trump. Trump never truly let him forget it. And finally, this from Ray. Ray says, Republicans get me nervous. He's up in northern Michigan. He says 24/7 Democrats are running ads about abortion. He goes, I hate to watch it. Why is President Trump not running ads in Michigan? I heard the same thing in Pennsylvania. I hope they're not saving. What are they saving money for? This is a big time, I think. Don't let them get ahead.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're continuing to watch what's going on with the Supreme Court. We got reporters there. We're supposed to, everybody's eyes are really on what's happened with the immunity case and the former president of the United States saying, how can you charge me? I'm working as a president. He was president when the documents case took place. They said he shouldn't have taken these documents. He was president on January 6th. If you want to prosecute him in Georgia, he's president of the United States. So the Supreme Court took this up because they could see an important precedent there. And we're supposed to get a decision as early as today. So maybe within this segment with me right now is Jeff Lax, a City College law professor at Kingsborough Community College and founder of Safe Campus, which advocates for Zionist Jews discriminated against and excluded on college campuses. And of course, they're doing studies now to find out about anti-Semitism and how toxic the environment is in places like Columbia, Harvard, and around the country, especially at City College. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Always great to be here.
All right, so we need you. Might need your legal views too to see if the Supreme Court. All right, but first things first. We saw about the eruptions on your campus. We heard about it first when that commencement address a couple of years ago. The anti-American words that were coming out of your valedictorian's mouth, and we began to understand how bad things were at City College. Where are we at right now with the investigation about anti-Semitism on campus?
Well, a total sham settlement just happened between the Department of Education. Office of Civil Rights, which was investigating 9 different anti-Semitism Title VI actions filed by different plaintiffs in the City University of New York. And basically, the Office of Civil Rights gave a heads up to CUNY, this is not going well for you. There are going to be terrible findings that you contributed to a hostile environment for Jews and that you didn't properly investigate any of these cases, basically, that came before you. So they said to CUNY, why don't we settle? And which is a total sham because in a regular court, you don't settle between the judge and the wrongdoer. You have the plaintiff, the victim involved. The victims were not involved here at all. They had no say in whether a settlement should happen or not or what the terms were. And the settlement, Brian, was a sham. They basically said that CUNY can investigate themselves. So hire their own investigative team and conduct an investigation themselves. And they also said that they can redo the investigations. And who's in charge of that? A woman by the name of Sally Abd Allah, who is the former director of one of the most extreme chapters of CARE, CARE Minnesota, and the leader of the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, which is an anti-Semitic movement, of that chapter. That's the chief diversity. That is the person in charge of all discrimination at CUNY.
So this is – and there's no financial settlement with anybody?
No.
So how many students do you think are affected by this? How many Jewish students do you have on campus?
Thousands. I mean, right. New York has
So are they as outraged as you are?
I don't even think a lot of them understand yet. Very few people have read the entire settlement agreement. I have read it, but most people have not read it.
How did you know that the government came to CUNY with this, came to City College with this assessment?
Well, I had a wonderful meeting actually on Tuesday in Chicago with Jim Jordan. We had a very small, intimate meeting that was off the record, so I can't talk about what was talked about in the meeting. But one of the people there was Ken Marcus, who was the former assistant secretary under President Trump of the Office of Civil Rights. And we talked about it a little bit, and he told me the way it works, which I was not familiar with, actually. And we spoke about the fact that the Office of Civil Rights, you know, can go to the wrongdoers here at CUNY and say, let's work something out. It's really bad. And so he was, you know, he has to be a little bit also diplomatic about it because he's the former secretary of that division. And he may be again if Trump wins re-election. So I can be honest, he has to be a little diplomatic about how good the division, the job they did was. And he was lukewarm. He did criticize them, not as much as I have. But he said basically they did say that CUNY committed violations of the Civil Rights Act. And that's, you know, I'm happy with that part of it. And so am I. But I'm not happy with the settlement. The settlement is a sham. Allowing CUNY to investigate themselves is a joke.
Right. Would you be trying to get part of that investigation? Is it possible they'll ask you?
is that a serious? Brian, they're trying to fire me. They put me under investigation
right now.
I was exonerated because it was they hired an outside organization to investigate me. For what? For filing an anti-Semitism complaint against BDS activists. That's right. What I was investigated for. I have a clean record. I do a good job. They lost. I was exonerated. Luckily, because they didn't do it, they hired an outside investigation to do it. I am the most hated person at that university.
So can you believe that there were protests at the October 7th exhibit downtown New York?
No, it's unbelievable. It's horrifying to the grandchild of a Holocaust survivor. It's horrifying.
So who are these people?
Well, you know, people think it's students and involved in all the protests, and it's really not students. I try to tell everybody, students want to go to college, get their degree, and get a good job. That's the 99.9% of students, and we all know that. And even within the activist students, most of them don't do these rallies. It's Marxist professors. The unions organize all this stuff. It is unbelievable. The unions get the funding. We have emails. Our organization has received emails from the union, secret emails that they don't want anyone to see. But we have like sources embedded in the union. And they've sent us emails showing that they have collaborated with, for example, the campus, the settlements that were on the Gaza encampments. They actually collaborated with them and helped organize them and strategize with those students. So it's really the Marxist faculty. It's really right now a collaboration between Islamist radicals and Marxist radicals who have nothing in common except for one thing. And what is that? They both want to destroy America's infrastructure and our culture.
Are you shocked to have this administration seem to have turned on Israel now?
I'm very upset. Am I shocked? No. This has been the direction, you know, I don't like getting political, but to be honest, the Democratic Party has allowed people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar to be mainstreamed. They never should have allowed it. It's, you know, it's really a disgrace because the Republican Party, at the first mention of a white supremacist movement, will reject it immediately. And the Democratic Party needs to learn how to do the same thing with the Rashida Tlaibs and the Ilhan Omars. They should reject them out of hand.
Well, Liz Bowman looks like he's going to lose the primary. That'll be great. He couldn't be more anti-Semitic. He's trying desperate to find some Jewish friends. I want you to see the Prime Minister of Israel, and then we'll talk about what happened after he said this. Cut 19.
When Secretary Blinken was recently here in Israel, we had a candid conversation. I said I deeply appreciated the support the U.S. has given Israel from the beginning of the war. But I also said something else. I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration has been withholding weapons and ammunition to Israel. Israel, America's closest ally, fighting for its life, fighting against Iran and our other common enemies. Secretary Blinken assured me that the administration is working day and night to remove these bottlenecks. I certainly hope that's the case. It should be the case. During World War II, Churchill told the United States, "Give us the tools, we'll do the job." And I say, give us the tools and we'll finish the job a lot faster.
Unbelievable. He said that and the administration is beside himself. Not saying he's not telling the truth, but because he did. They want to keep this behind closed doors. Your reaction?
Yeah, it's. I don't know what to say except for that this has been a bipartisan issue for so many decades. And it should remain so. And the direction the Biden administration is going for a few points in Michigan. Let's be honest. This is about 2 points in Michigan. That's what it's about.
Because the majority of the country is still on the side of Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, this is about Michigan. And how – I think if it was – not that I think Biden has ever been great on this issue, because I think he's really vacillated on this. But it's an election year. It's months away. He's even though today's Fox poll shows that he's now slightly up.
In Michigan, though.
Not in Michigan. And that's what he's fighting over, 2 points in Michigan.
Right, and it's a shame because what's the interpretation in the Middle East that we're equivocating and makes the Israel more vulnerable? Hamas thinks they're winning.
Yeah, they do. They do because they don't care about their own civilians dying for them to win the PR war.
Right, and that's more than discouraging. Yep. Are you shocked at a city that allowed 9/11 to happen, that we haven't learned enough to now we allow people wearing Hamas regalia and their faces covered looking like the second coming of Yasser Arafat to happen in this city?
Doesn't it feel like a different world than the 9/11 world? I don't feel like I'm in the same world as the 9/11 world. You and I, I'm sure, had the same reaction.
Someone saying pro-Hamas? We'd never dream of somebody saying
that. Unbelievable. And listen, let me give Governor Hochul a little credit here because she did speak out the other day, I think it was yesterday, against people wearing masks in public now. So that's a little bit different than what you're talking about. But that is true, too. You shouldn't be able to hide your face and commit assaults on Jews.
No, I agree with you. I was talking here with Jeff Lax. He's a CUNY professor over at Kingsborough Community College and founder of Safe Campus, which advocates the Zionist Jews discriminated against and excluded on college campuses. Now, the other thing is they're now putting out asking the public to support them as they try to find out who those Hamas sympathizers were on the subway who was saying, "Zionists, this is your last chance to leave." And they're trying to see who didn't cover their face and try to round up the rest of them. Your reaction to hearing that chant?
Oh, my God. Visceral, horrific, terrifying. My first thought is, what if I was there? What would I do if I was there?
Right.
And, I don't know.
Well, I mean, he says, this is your last chance to leave.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys look like they're in their 20s.
Brian, can I tell you the truth? I'm going to tell you something that I really shouldn't say because my wife is going to kill me and my mother's going to kill me. There's some things that I say to you. My mom kills me afterwards. Right. OK, I would stay. I would stay. I would not move an inch. And my mother's going to hear this. She's going to scream at me because she's going to say, "You crazy? You're going to get killed." And I'm like, "Mom, I'm doing this for the next generation. I'm doing this for my kids. I'm doing it for my grandparents, bless their memories."
Yeah, I mean, Sid Rosenberg, this great WABC morning show host, was on the subway. They started screaming at him, "Are you Jewish?" And he sat down right next to the guy and said, "I'm Jewish too. What are you going to do?" But the guy ended up walking away. But you have to show some fight.
Yeah. Yes. And right. I tell that to everybody. I tell any student, one of the big questions I get asked so often is, "Should I send my kid to college?" And I'm like, wow, I've never expected to get a question like that in
what
my
college?
Life. Yeah, they say, "What college?" or "College." And I say, listen, you got to go to the best school for what you want to do with your life. Don't let this, speak out. We need more people to speak out because when people don't speak out, that, the old motto, right, which is the old adage, the only thing evil needs to succeed is good men to remain silent.
Absolutely. So, Jeff, great to see you. Congratulations on putting together this organization by highlighting what's gone wrong with this decision and hopefully find out more and we get some answers before they come back. These kids come back to school in September.
I hope so. Thank you so much, as always.
All right, Jeff Lax, thanks so much. When we come back, Brian Kilmeade, we have more.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
No one came in here and said we were going to be WNBA champions from day one in our locker room. Like, that was never our goal. Our goal was to get back to the playoffs, and we're fighting for that every single night. Like, this is the first time we've won 4 home games in a row since 2015. Like, you have to have perspective on things, and that goes for life, too. Like, have perspective on life, and there just needs to be solid perspective on what this team can accomplish, and I think everybody in our locker room had that, and nobody ever hung our heads. We had the hardest schedule to start. We didn't get to practice much, and we're playing with the most inexperienced team in the WNBA. So, I mean, I think it's just this group is, starting to click and build some chemistry, and it's one day at a time. But I think we all kept good perspective on knowing we just need to get better at one step at a time, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
There you go. That is Caitlin. And Caitlin is talking about the Indiana Fever and talking about the WNBA. And she was weighing in on just the fact that they were the worst team of the league for the last 2 years. She comes and joins the team. She's averaging 23 points. So Caitlin Carr comes and joins the Fever. The fact that they're not winning right away, people think it's a disaster. But they won their third straight game. Final score yesterday, 88-81 over the Washington Mystics on Wednesday night. And here's the thing. She had 18 points, career high 12 rebounds, 6 assists. She's running out to being a more than an effective player, certainly the focal point of that team. And the best news is that people care about the WNBA. Even if they want to say, well, she's being treated unfairly, they're being treated too fair, she's being beat up, or she doesn't deserve it. Whatever it is, when you're a young league, you need people talking about you. And that helps sell that story. And I think they really picked the right person to be able to do that because she can play. Real quick thing on the debates. So there's two different ways for both men to prepare for these debates. And Joe Biden is astoundingly taken off basically a week, and he's going to be drilling it. And they're going to have people, I think Bob Bauer is going to be playing Trump. For Trump, he's not doing that, but he is taking it serious. One of his biggest critics, who fashions herself an insider, Maggie Haberman of New York Times, says this. Cut one.
Trump is taking this more seriously than people allow publicly, right? I mean, in public, his aides often downplay the prep that he does.
Right.
He's been doing not standard debate prep. He doesn't have stand-ins as of now for Biden. They are focusing on various issues that could come up, abortion, health care, energy, COVID, and then very specifically, and this was one thing that came up last Thursday, what Trump will say when asked January 6th related questions.
Yeah. I think he's got to take it and parry it. What happened January 6th was the worst investigation he's ever seen in his life, they'll probably say. He said, what people don't know, that Nancy Pelosi had actually admitted on camera. I offered the backup. She refused it. She said it on camera. Go back and listen to her own daughter's documentary or the thing that was on the cutting room floor that's now public. But for the most part, people don't care about January 6th. You want to talk about that, Joe. You know why you want to talk about that, Joe? Because you don't want to talk about inflation. You don't want to talk about the world that you allow to fall to pieces, allow our enemies to get fortified and combine to forces against us. You don't want to talk about the disaster in Afghanistan. You don't want to talk about your infrastructure bill that has all of 8 power terminals for electric cars being built at the cost, and with $42 billion for rural for the internet. Into rural communities in this country, not one line has been dug or laid. Not one penny has been spent still. You don't want to talk about all these things. You don't want to talk about $1.9 trillion over budget this year. And that's how I would do it. Cut to.
Trump doesn't like prep. I mean, he considers it school. So the fact that they've gotten him to do it this way is actually pretty revealing, and also speaks to the fact that I think he knows that this has to go well for him. He has said to people multiple times that he knows that he interrupted too much in the first debate with Biden in 2020. And having just rewatched that debate recently, it's really striking. I mean, we all talked about it at the time, but Biden could barely get a word in edgewise, and Biden was kind of smiling throughout as this was happening.
Yeah, and I'm going to take a look at that debate again. I also saw some clips of it last night. But good. I mean, this is one thing that's solely different about Donald Trump. And I think the best example is how he's treated Larry Hogan. Larry Hogan came out with a comment that you had to respect the jury's decision. No comment from Trump. Larry Trump says something. Other people said something. He didn't. And then when we're asked about Governor Hogan, do you want him to be the next senator for Maryland? He said, sure. And then when they came out right afterwards, they said, we are not. I've never voted for Donald Trump in 2016 or 2020. I'm not going to vote for him now. Then silence. That's the discipline. He's never had it before because he knows he needs the majority in the Senate. He knows he's a conservative. He also knows that if he came out and said, Larry Hogan is great, Larry Hogan loses. The best thing to happen to Larry Hogan, he might not even mean what he just said. He might even be calling Trump behind the scenes saying, listen, the further I'm from you, the better a chance to have to win for you and the party. So keep your powder dry. Let me do my own thing. I'm the only Republican that can win here. And who knows? Tim Shee's a great candidate, but he's trailing in Montana. Dave McCormick's a fantastic candidate, but he's trailing in Pennsylvania. West Virginia is definitely going to go the Republicans' way. But where's the win elsewhere? Where else can he win? We'll discuss it. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. That's Sandra Smith. I was going to make it a surprise, but now she blew the surprise. But if you were watching Fox Nation on the stream, you're seeing that she is now here. Sandra Smith is fresh off filling in for Dana Perino in America's Newsroom. She's going to be doing her show, America Reports.
I can't quite figure out where the
camera is. Right. You know, the camera responds to us, right? I'm not even sure. It is almost like it's divinely just figures us out. I guess it's heat-oriented or it goes with our voice. But it'll light up wherever we are.
You know,
are.
I was saying I did Kennedy's podcast, by the way. Hi. Thanks for having me. And she served me a mocktail. And so I didn't see anything that you were offering. So I brought my own coffee.
Oh, was it a mocktail or a cocktail? We're not really sure.
It's totally a mocktail.
Right. Okay. But yeah, we do need, like, why don't we reserve refreshments? Do we have that type of budget, Allison? We don't? Okay.
Not really.
Yeah. You can play the Brian Kilmeade radio show home game. We give you that as a going away prize.
Oh,
you could pretend
is that
to be.
Like a, is that like a thing?
Yeah, it is. It's huge. It's, okay. It's taking the country by storm. Bottom of the hour, General Jack Keane on the world, really dividing up between the good guys and bad guys right before our eyes. Sandra, first off, in terms of Supreme Court decisions, we're all ready to go. Allison just took out her law degree again just to get ready for it, but we didn't get much of a decision today. We didn't find out about the president's immunity and where they stand. But what did we find out?
No, really, the cases that we had a long list of priority cases. We did not get any of them. So this could go weeks. You know, I mean, we're getting pretty close. Like we're inching our way to. Oh, there's the camera. We're getting pretty close here to where we're gonna have the debate next week. And the top issues are going to be key. Timing's going to be everything once we do get the immunity. From SCOTUS, that's going to be everything, because then we're going to have to lay out how that's going to affect the campaign, how that's going to affect former President Donald Trump's campaigning. But yeah, Hemmer and I thought Hemmer jinxed us for a second. You know, he said, you know, sometimes this is going to go well beyond when they even say they're going to release the cases. This is going to overflow into July. And I said, that means we're getting it in 2 hours.
So for people that said the immunity decision should not even been hard, the Supreme Court should not even take it. Well, they did take it. And the fact that they're waiting so long to come up with it has people like Eric Holder, the former attorney general, saying this. Cut 27.
Anything less than a decision by the Supreme Court that says a president should be held to the laws just like any other American citizen should be, anything other than that is absurd. The notion, for instance, that apparently some justices are fooling around with it. Well, if the president violated the criminal law but was doing so in his official capacity, there may be some basis to say that that's okay. We need to step back and think about that. You know, wait a minute. A president can violate the American criminal law if he or she is doing something in their official capacity. That is an absurd and dangerous conclusion. And I'm worried, given the length of time that it has taken for the Supreme Court to decide this case, that something along those lines might come out of the Supreme Court.
To some, I guess they're saying that this is deliberate because they quite obviously could have easily come to a ruling much sooner. But the longer this drags on, I think raises the likelihood that there would not be a trial till after Election Day. But that's all I can tell you. We did not get anything today.
But some people said, too, for Supreme Court speed, this is fast. They took it. They said, we're going to get back to you by the end of June. So let's
Fair.
Do it. And then we talk about immunity. I don't think a complete immunity is on the table. It's in the cards. I think they're talking about where is it? Where is the line? For example, Joe Biden decided through a series of executive orders to open up our border. And if my relative got killed or my kid got killed, I might turn around and say, when this guy's out of office, I'm suing him. Maybe look what happened. You know, you brought me into a war illegally in Vietnam or whatever. I'm going to sue LBJ. Mm-hmm. Your policies allow crime to run wild in New York City, and you didn't put a recidivist criminal behind closed doors. And my son got killed in a bank robbery by a guy that should have been in jail. I'm going to sue. So that's what they're trying to find. Judging by the arguments, there might be a sweet spot in between.
Yeah, and I think precedent's going to be an issue. We've had our constitutional law professors say we haven't been here before, so this could set the precedent going forward. So it has all kinds of implications.
Right, because he was president. This whole thing is because President Trump was president.
Correct.
January 6th.
Yep.
He was president when the documents were put on a chopper,
yep,
and they were choppered out. And those are the two cases that are in delay.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is pretty clear. I was a little bit surprised by the polls. Has Trump trailing by 1 or 2 points head-to-head, and even in a five-way race? Does that show you that there's been some damage from the court case decision?
Possibly. They made the case during the process that this was only boosting Trump in the polls. The polls are the polls. Karl Rove was joining us earlier, and he said that this is going to be a make-or-break moment, the debate next Thursday night. And the reason why this is quite possibly the make-or-break moment is because traditionally you have another debate that would quickly follow. You're not going to get another debate until September, he was pointing out. So whatever happens in that debate Thursday night is going to matter. So we were talking about all the details of the debate, the rules of the debate. I was talking to Jerry Baker from the Wall Street Journal yesterday about how the rules might benefit one candidate over the other. If cutting off President Trump's mic, will he keep talking even though his mic is clipped and only Biden would hear him? Would that make him stumble over his next response? I mean, there's all kinds of ways that people are looking at this. But I think as far as the polls are concerned, and you look at the issues that matter the most to the American people, you look at the primary season, how it was about immigration. Every single state, it was about immigration. That was the top of the list. To some, we mm-hmm. were surprised the economy wasn't up there number one. Well, the economy is moving back up there as the top issue for voters. So heading into November, there's, as you say, you can easily say in politics, there's still a lot of time left
right.
here, and a lot can change. A lot can change with prices and interest rates and the Federal Reserve's next move on the economy. Immigration seems to continue to rear its ugly head through growing crime in some of these major cities. I mean, we just sat down this morning, Brian, with one of the men, it was about 10 of them, who waited outside that deli to stop that illegal migrant, someone who was never supposed to be here in the first place, who now allegedly raped this 13-year-old girl in Queens. And we spoke to him. He had to take matters into his own hands. He's got two daughters of his own, lives in that community, says he won't allow it. You've got this immigration crime problem popping up in cities all over the country, far from the border. So a lot can move on these issues. A lot can move in the polls, is my point.
Yeah, I think that as President Trump said in a speech the other day, he said that a lot of these criminals are just getting comfortable. You know, there's 7.4 million here that we know of illegally since Joe Biden took office. How many of them don't belong here just to commit crimes? I mean, this alleged rapist was just walking around in broad daylight, thought he'd not only do it, but tape it. I mean, and just brazenly said it. I mean, what kind of twisted mind gets through our border, able to go to the number one city and just attack?
You know, Rosanna Scotto just joined us, and according to her police sources, through which she learned that he felt so comfortable in this situation where he was allegedly raping this girl. There was another boy in the attack that he picked up his cell phone and taped it. She said that they're not ruling out he could have picked up their cell phones and taped it. We don't know yet. She's still working the story. We're still working the story. But to your point, they're feeling more and more comfortable because there's no accountability. We're not sending
right.
these guys to jail. We're not holding them accountable. And it was a bunch of members of the community that had to stop him and take matters into their own hands.
So, I mean, let's take breaking this down right now when it comes to issues that matter to the American people. First off, Donald Trump trailing by 2 to Joe Biden nationally, which means very little at this point. But just to break it down, Trump's got a 15-point lead with men. Rural voters, 17. White men without a degree, 30. White evangelicals, 50-point lead. Voters age 65 and over. This was shocking to me.
Mm-hmm.
57-42 Biden. Biden's got the older vote. That's a little surprising. Women, 58-41 Biden. Urban voters, 61-38 Biden. White women with a college degree, 64-36. All in all, that's a 2-point.
You know what Karl Rove said? Where's the hate both category? Because you've got those, right, that won't vote for either of
Who
them.
Who he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not a fan of either.
Well, I mean, we were just talking about where's the polling on that. Look, you know, for those out there who say they don't like the decision that they have to make, they're forced to make one if they go out and vote. And it's tough. This is the environment that we're in, and we've been in this for a while. And I wonder to you, Brian, if I flip the script, do you think the VP choice matters a lot?
It's one of these things where I always look at it, it's your first big decision. So John McCain's first big decision ended up being a huge mistake. Mm. And it just sacrificed the fact that he's got the experience to, and the steadiness against this new guy named Barack Obama, who won for experience, got Joe Biden. So John McCain went for somebody without experience, who didn't really know our American history or anything, was way over her head, kind of destroyed her life. It's not her fault in retrospect. But he went, that was a bad decision. So it neutralized the one thing he had, and that was steadiness under power, experience to act. So I think that there's two things. Who's going to help him get the job, mm-hmm. and who's going to actually do great with the job? Doug Burgum, to set up systems. Hey, you know, let's say there's a problem with the economy. Doug, take it. Problem with the border. We need organization. Doug, take it. Why? He's formed four or five companies, sold them for millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars. He knows what it's like to work in a ranch. He knows what it's like to run a
state. Does he energize voters, though?
So to help him get the vote, to win the sparring session with Kamala Harris, and to go into enemy territory, the strongest are Tom Cotton and Marco Rubio. They do the best arguing for the president. I think the other candidates.
So are you ruling out the Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the Nikki Haley's and the?
Oh yeah.
Are all the, none of those, I mean, are in the cards?
I don't think. I talked to somebody who just spoke to Nikki Haley, and she's not over it. So there's no way she could be number two. And plus,
well, she endorsed him.
Which is, you know, she said, yeah, vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there'll be a cover. But to be on the ticket, mm-hmm. that's a huge leap.
I think Donald Trump said when he stepped outside of one of his trials, he was asked about this. And he said that she'll have a place somewhere on his team. So that led to speculation that maybe she was still in the running, but perhaps not.
So, yeah, I mean, Doug Burgum's going to go out there. I think he's so competent. And now he's just going to get used to the fact that when you go on these other channels, Sandra, they want two things. Mm. They want to talk about January 6th. They want to say, are you going to accept the results of the last election? And they want to talk about what happened last election. Okay. Abortion, of course. But we kind of know like where you stand. The problem with Doug Burgum, you brought up probably his weakness is 6 weeks in North Dakota. So they'll say, you're for 6 weeks in North Dakota. Why wouldn't we think that you're just for banning all abortion in our country? So that hurt Ron DeSantis when he went to 6 weeks. It helped that Marco Rubio came out and said, I'm pro-life, but Florida says 15 weeks. So I'm going to run for senator. I'm not going to touch it. He won easily. So Governor DeSantis had a hard time with that. And Donald Trump said, man, you made a mistake on that. Mm. So I'm wondering if that hurts Doug Burgum.
And Tim Scott, I haven't heard you mention him.
I think Tim Scott's still in a good place. I think his greatest asset's on display today. He is having a fundraiser. Evidently, a lot of money people are supporting Tim Scott. And he's showing that he can raise money. And he's got a great personal story, and you don't have to worry about his loyalty.
J.D. Vance?
I'm not a fan of J.D. Vance's foreign policy. Makes me really nervous about that. For him not to see the value in having success in Ukraine blows me away. How could he not know what Russia has done in Georgia? How does he not know what they've done in Ukraine? How does he not know that they're already infiltrating into the elections of the Baltic countries? Mm-hmm. How could he not be worried about them, their alliance with North Korea? And how could he not see that it's all related to their success and struggles in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. And to me, if Donald Trump has isolationist tendencies, you need someone like Rubio and Cotton who understand it's Trump's show, but will reason with them to say, this is why Ukraine matters. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that J.D. Vance will go, yeah, I hear you. Let's pull out. Mm-hmm. Let's not worry about the West. Oh, let's not worry about Europe. Let's not worry about Ukraine. They're an imperfect democracy. Zelensky, I don't know. He's too short. Whatever they want to come up with.
Yeah, I was writing something down to go back to your question about the polling and the older vote going Biden. And I think that's really interesting because in the economy, something we have looked at a lot and talked a lot about is those living on a fixed income in this country have had a rough time of it with utilities going up, energy prices up across the board. It's expensive and it's taken away from your ability to spend that money on anything else. You're spending a lot more now just to live. However, the rich have gotten richer under Joe Biden's economic policies. And if you're an older voter in this country and you're on economic sound footing, you're established, you're in the stock market, you've got savings, you have probably benefited. You probably are doing better. It's the lower income brackets that are struggling the most with high prices and inflation.
Very little margin
for error. And so you might be an older voter who says, well, I've got kids, I've got grandkids. I don't like the uncertainty of Donald Trump. you know, I don't know what's coming around the corner. So this is the lesser yeah. bad choice. I think there's a couple different ways you could look at that. A
couple of things. I think Trump's mindset has everything to do with setting people at ease. Have a good time again. You know, he's having a good time out there. Mm. And if he comes in tense and angry, I think people go, okay, I don't need that. You know, that's exhausting. But if he comes in, he's smiling, he's like, and he's able to look at the folly of Joe Biden's foreign policy, the ridiculous accusation that it was at 9% when he took over, that the infrastructure plan is actually being implemented well when we know only 8 terminals have been built and no Wi-Fi has been sent to rural communities. Like when he was able to point that out, just have a good time. Right? Can't interrupt anyway. No pressure to interrupt.
I think I said this on The Five the other night with the gang. I said, just be honest. How about we just start there? Yeah. Because you've had an administration that's been telling you things are one way that they are not.
Especially with these so-called cheap fakes.
Oh, the videos.
Yeah.
Oh, man. What you're seeing, you know, don't believe your lying eyes. And I've told our viewers, look, every time, and I see it on our network right now, every time that we have played that video, we have played it in its entirety so that our viewers can decide. And when I heard Karine Jean-Pierre live on our show one day step up at the microphone, it was the first time she was giving a briefing in 3 weeks. So she was finally asked about these videos. Not only did she call them cheap fakes, but she said that they were manipulated.
Wow.
And that really bothered me because manipulating video, that means you're putting his head on somebody else's body. That's an issue. Sandra, that's not what's happening.
Not at all. And then President called them clean fakes, and he'll discuss that too. A couple more minutes with Sandra Smith when we come back. Her show starts at 2. We'll find out who's going to be on that show. She ultimately makes the decision, not John Roberts.
I better make something
more
up.
More than that, yes. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, Sandra Smith, we got 90 seconds.
Whoa.
Your show with America Reports is coming up at 2 o'clock. Besides me, who is really the focal point of your show, you've been promoting it for weeks now. Who else do you have on your show?
We've got our econ panel at the top, Robert Wolf and Steve Moore. Love those two together. They'll be joining us live. Mark Thiessen on the latest polling as we head into the debate next week. Kennedy's also on set, as well as Judge Jeanine Pirro. So much to talk about. And I cannot wait till you join us, Brian Kilmeade. Larry Kudlow will also be on set.
Social question. You saw Governor Newsom begin to make a movement to ban cell phones in schools, social media movement in New York.
Great.
Ban kids below the age of 14 from using social media. Your thoughts?
Great. Do it. How do you enforce it? It's a huge problem already. There's schools that already say you can't do it. You can't use them in the school. And then when the kids do, the teachers have a hard time. It takes up a lot of their time to enforce it. So you have to have a plan, a thorough plan to deal with kids walking through the doors
right.
with their devices.
Right. I mean, there is a way of enforcing. We were just talking about, hey, you got to show up on school on time. You got classes. And when you come in, if there are cubbies in the beginning, guys, put it or just a basket. Phones in the basket or we can't go forward. I think most schools can enforce that.
Kids need less distraction. They need to learn reading, writing, arithmetic. Get back to it.
I have news for you. I just think that most kids want to give it up if everyone else would just give it up.
I totally agree.
Just promise me everyone gives up and then they'll free them to be kids again.
Agree.
All right. Sandra Smith, we'll see you at 2 o'clock. Coming
Thank
up next,
you,
General Jack Keane. And yes, I said General Jack Keane to get you jealous.
Love it.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Putin sees he's trying to get nuclear proxies in Iran and North Korea to do what he thinks we're doing in Ukraine. And Ukraine is not nuclear. More importantly, he looks at Biden and he says either he's debilitated and he won't react, or the Obamas are in control. And I remember what they did in 2014 when I took the Donbass and the Crimea, and I remember the hot mic and soul. So whatever it is, it's an open window for me.
Military historian Victor Davis Hanson weighing in on what he believes Vladimir Putin is doing in North Korea. Now he heads over to Vietnam and heads back, and he's trying to, it looks like he signed a mutual defense pact with North Korea. South Korea, Japan, alarmed by that. We also see that a Filipino ship was rammed by a Chinese ship yesterday. We're allies with the Philippines. And somebody who handles it all the hotspots around the world with the Institute of Study of War. He's a Fox News contributor, retired 4-star general, the chairman of that Institute of Study of War, Fox News senior strategic analyst, General Jack Keane. General, how alarmed were you, not surprised, but alarmed were you to see this this alliance really fortify in North Korea?
Yeah. China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are truly collaborating and cooperating together. The synergies that they've achieved together has surprised all of us, so much so that we believe at the Institute and also the Congressional Commission I'm on looking at our adversaries and our threat, that we haven't faced anything on this kind of scale since World War II. And the reason is we can be involved in war directly ourselves in more than one region. An example, if Putin has his way in Ukraine because we take a knee and we walk away, he expands into Europe. That's a huge incentive for Xi to move on Taiwan. He knows full well the United States would absolutely have great difficulty dealing with two theaters at the same time. That's just one example. We're resourced, according to the defense budget, to fight one war and deter all others. We used to be resourced during the Cold War to fight two and a half. So, and our budgets have been flat. So just looking at the money situation, we have problems. So, yes, these four nations and the cooperation they achieved is significant. Think of this. China is financing Iran's proxy war because they're buying Iran's fuel, and they're flush with money. And they no secondary sanctions on China from the administration. They won't touch it. It's like a third rail. The Trump administration would be all over that and would shut down that oil buying. Secondly, look what's happening in Ukraine. China buying Russian oil, and Russia obviously is working around the sanctions as a result of it, supplying on a scale to help their defense industrial base, everything short of a weapon, what it takes to build a weapon, but also what it takes to keep an army on the battlefield. There's a lot of things that aren't weapons to do that. They're helping with that. Iran is providing a significant amount of drones and missiles to assist them. Korea is providing artillery shells by the tens of thousands and also ballistic missiles to help them. This is significant in what is going on with this cooperation and collaboration that's taken place.
And Ukraine is sitting there. They had to wait a while for their $64 billion. Got it. But how much of that in terms of material weaponry has arrived?
Some of it has arrived. More has to. It is starting to make a difference for them with the artillery shells. The air defense systems is something they need desperately because Russia, while their offensive operations haven't been able to achieve very much, even though Putin has mobilized 300,000, 23 to 24, year 23 to 24, not all of those are on the battlefield, but most of them are. But what has showed up? Soldiers poorly trained, once again, poorly led, once again, high casualties, once again. So they've never been able to exploit the small tactical success they've had operationally to grab huge amount of territory is what you should do. Secondly, though, they have had an effective air campaign, and they've been taking down neighborhoods and cities, whole towns, and they have damaged 50% of Ukraine's infrastructure. Why is this? Because Ukraine has not had the air defense systems that they used to have, given the holdup here for 6 months in terms of providing those air defense systems to them. They're in route. Some have arrived, and eventually they will make a difference.
Yeah, it's just a shame it's happening this way, but soon they're going to need to be replenished, and this is going to continue. So let me ask you, in terms of Russia, we get two stories. Early on, they couldn't believe how poorly they were doing, couldn't believe how hard it was going. But have they changed their economy to the point where they're actually profiting as they've gone to a military economy? Are they now doing their own manufacturing of drones like the ones Iran has? And is it more than just importing North Korea? They're beginning to be able to make their own stuff.
Yeah, they've gone to a war footing economy, much as they did during World War II. And, of course, they've conditioned their people to expect a little bit less as a result of it. And you know, Putin cast this whole thing at the West is encroaching on them, and we have to fight back against these neo-Nazis inside Ukraine, which are an instrument of the United States. And all of that is being bombarded on the Russian people on a regular basis. Thus, except the economic conditions not being as good as they used to be. But, yes, Iran has built a factory for drones in Russia. And Iran is helping to operate it, and so are the Russians. They built the factory, and that has their technology. So, yes, things like that are absolutely happening.
So North Korea right now, known as the Hermit Kingdom, are they beginning to come out of it thanks to aid, any type of aid that Russia is going to give them? Could this be their way back into maybe revitalizing, not even revitalizing, but vitalizing their economy?
No, it won't go that far. But Russia has always helped them out to get around sanctions in transiting oil into them. They do it at sea, you know, through third parties. So they've done that even during the Trump administration. But what they want from Russia here is they want advanced satellite technology, because they're a nation that's really not a part of the global information grid. They need to get the satellites up, telecommunication satellites.
They really want that? Do they want their people to know how bad they have it?
They want to be able to operate themselves effectively as a military force to be able to manage the problems and challenges that they have. Not so much that their people are going to be well-informed. That's a very good point. They certainly don't want any part of that, but they want satellite technology to assist them. And they would like some of Russia's advanced weapons as well. Now, North Korea does very well. They obviously have a nuclear arsenal, but they do very well at rockets and ballistic missiles.
So when you look at China, they can't go all in like Russia. For example, they need the European market. They need the West market. It gives us a leverage to a degree to say, hey, listen, you better not be doing that, or else there's going to be a massive backlash. The European Union is starting to stand up, too, at least in words, and say, you know, we don't like the way you're resupplying or using dual-use items to get them over to Russia. We do have some leverage where we might have minimal leverage over North Korea and Russia, right?
Yes. And during the Cold War, Russia economy was always in a tank. And that obviously separated them quite a bit from the United States, because we had such an economic advantage. They had a military advantage, but we had an economic advantage. And eventually it was that economy, that communist system, that collapsed. China, on the other hand, even though it's a communist system, because Deng Xiaoping brought in capitalism and some aspects of a free market, that their economy has flourished. It's not as good as ours, but clearly it's a powerhouse of an economy, and it is a strength of theirs. But you're absolutely right. Look, we've made a lot of progress. The Congress of the United States and the American people, we have bipartisan support and consensus that China is the number one threat in the world out there to the United States economic security and prosperity. And that is progress that has been made. The China Select Committee that Gallagher ran, is now being run by John Molinar, has helped to expose that. And you're absolutely right. We have got to de-link technology that we are doing with China that is used to repress their own people or is used to advance their military capability. And that has been a steep learning curve we're on. One, to come to grips with what that is, and then two, to enforce the delinkage.
I mean, and that's got to be whoever wins this election, if there's a change in administration, they got to address this right away. And one leverage point might seem to say, hey, Japan, you might want to change your constitution, because I think from a more defense to a more offensive defense strategy or posture. How much does it freak out China to this day that what Japan did to them in World War II and what they might be able to do to them again if they ever started arming up?
Well, Japan has changed the constitution, and it's as you suggest. You know, they've gone from the passivity post-World War II to recognizing it as a major threat there, and they're developing offensive missile capability, et cetera. And they entered into a trilateral agreement with the United States, South Korea, and Japan. And to bring South Korea and Japan together, given their historic differences and given the wars they fought and the occupation that has taken place by Japan, it is absolutely stunning. But they have a common enemy in China. And that's the reality. Japan is there. They are upgunned. They have done everything but say, if you go to Taiwan, we're coming for you.
So are they concerned as much about a Taiwan invasion as we are?
Oh, yeah. They are. I think they're probably even more concerned because, look, China has been pushing on the islands off the coast of Japan and saying that they really are islands, and they've been intimidating, coercing them, maybe not on the scale of Taiwan, but on a similar scale, you know, to really push them back and sort of take a knee and capitulate to the major power in the region. We're too big for you, and we're going to have our way and our influence. You know, they're a bully in the region. Japan has stood up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And Philippines. China is pushing on the Philippines because Marcos came in, separated himself from his predecessor, aligned almost immediately with the United States. Then as a result of Secretary Austin doing some remarkable negotiations with them, they give us four military bases to use. Three of them are close to Taiwan. And they are so frustrated by that, the Chinese. So they are very aggressive with the Philippines to discourage them from continuing this relationship with the United States. But Marcos, he's not going to back down. He knows his future security is tied to the United States.
And we got to be willing to defend them to a degree.
There's
sure.
no doubt about that.
So they start ramming ships. What are we going to do to help them out, to make them make this thing to the alliance as a benefit to them? General, when we come back, I'd like to talk about the latest with Israel and the U.S., as well as Israel and Hezbollah and Hamas feeling like they're winning because they're surviving. I listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. More with General Jack Keane in just a moment.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration has been withholding weapons and ammunition to Israel.
We generally do not know what he's talking about.
That is a little of the back and forth between the U.S. and Israel. It's pretty extraordinary. The prime minister says you slowed up weapons that we need to fight. What are you doing? And the administration got so upset that they no longer are going to allow Prime Minister Netanyahu to go to the Oval Office and meet with the president when he comes here. And it could be even worse behind closed doors with us still as General Jack Keane. General, who's right in this dispute? Did they slow down weapons deliveries over to Israel?
I honestly don't know. But listen, the guy I trust in these discussions is the prime minister.
He's the one at war.
Yeah, and it's his people that are security that's at stake. He knows he's in an existential threat to the survival of his nation. And that's what we've got to remind ourselves constantly, what is going on here when we think about this war, when we think about the civilian casualties, which are horrific, but they can be explained by Hamas's behavior contributing to that, and that Israel is under a gun that they have not been under since they were formed in 1948. And that's the reality of it. And they are literally fighting for the existence of the state of Israel. And Iran has operationalized their proxies to support Hamas. I believe from my sources that Iran has thought through this problem. They see this as a win for them in terms of they've now got Israel in a protracted war, taking casualties. Gradually their people are going to be worn down by it. International community, widespread isolation of Israel politically and condemnation, certainly even more so. Sinwar sees it as a win. Iran sees it as a win. And I think what Iran is talking about the next time, as opposed to Hamas initiating something and the rest of them getting operationalized to support it, do it all together, synchronized, coordinated, all at one time coming at Israel from multiple vantage points.
Well, we saw a couple of months ago.
Yeah, all at once. And then once and for all, end the state of Israel. That's where these guys' minds are, and we've got to get our head around how dead serious they are. And the fact that this administration will not confront Iran as the architect of what is taking place in the Middle East and going after Israel, driving the United States military presence out of the region, is a huge strategic failure on their part. And they're running up the risk for Israel, and they're running up the risk for U.S. interests in the region.
And the U.S. is so concerned about expanding this war, but can Israel afford not to push Hezbollah back in the north?
If Hezbollah does not go back from the Israeli border and pull away so that the Israeli citizens, some 80,000, can move back into their homes, if they don't do that, and Israel believes they will not do that, then they have no choice but to force them back. They can do it with air power only, or they can do it with air power and ground power. And if they need help from the United States, I would assume that we would help them. Hezbollah, in return, as a result of that, will unleash swarms of missiles and rockets that have lethality and precision and range that Hamas does not have. They can reach every town and city in Israel, and they will try to overwhelm the air defense system so that Israel begins to take significant civilian casualties. That would be their intent.
Right. And in the in Hamas, by surviving, they're winning. And Sinwar says, let's not have a big fight in Rafah. Let's stay underground and live to fight another day, because he sees public sentiment waning and he sees pressure growing. And if he survives despite all the deaths, he feels like he won.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You couldn't have said it any better than what you just said. In Rafah, the Israelis have moved more deliberately, more modestly. They have taken two of the four battalions down and rendered them ineffective. There's two others that they're degrading. Some of the Hamas fighters that were in Rafah did move out of there when hostilities began. I suspect that Sinwar is out of there as well. Don't know for a fact, but he's likely probably gone north to his hometown in Han Yunus in the tunnel complexes somewhere. They have used less air power, and they have used precision-guided munitions, particularly the small diameter bombs, in going after military infrastructure. So in a sense, they have taken some of the counsel of the United States.
Right. Right,
when it came to Rafah, I think they felt they had to tip their hat to the United States a little bit, to be frank about it. But the thing that the administration did not want them to do is to go in there. They are in there, and they're going about doing what they want to do, is destroy those four battalions. And remarkably, they get no credit for this. They moved 1 million people. They encouraged 1 million people, 1 million people to leave the area, and they did. And the administration was wringing their hands over the fact that, oh, my God, you can't do this. You can't go in there. All these people are going to be killed. And look what they accomplished.
General, look what you accomplished by explaining to America what exactly is going on in the two hot spots in the world. Thanks so much.
Now, it's always great talking to you, Brian. You know what you're talking about, and you got an
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.